The cell and gene therapy industry is rightly proud of its achievements to date. New approvals are being announced almost monthly, and treatments for indications with much larger patient populations are on the horizon. Though, with high price tags and cumbersome manufacturing methods, are we doing enough to ensure that the benefits of these therapies are going to be accessible to all those in need? In order to bring down costs and streamline manufacturing, where should we turn? Traditional methods of process development rely heavily on legacy equipment and labor-intensive handling steps. Decisions that are taken early on in a therapy's development can have a dramatic effect on the ability to scale manufacturing. And this can result in considerable time and expense in deploying the processes in production. So today we ask, can new ways of thinking about process development allow cell and gene therapies to scale to meet patient demand? Join me, Stuart Lowe, as we uncover the future of cell and gene therapy. In this episode, I'll be joined by Tay Salamullah and Jason Jones. Tay is Chief Access Commercial Officer at Novartis Gene Therapies, where he helps build global access to cell and gene therapies. Jason is the Global Business Development Lead at Cellular Origins, an organization that brings advanced robotic automation to the cell and gene therapy industry. In this episode, we set out to answer one question. Why? Why is it imperative that we move forward? Why do we need to continue innovating in this field? And in exploring this question, we'll come face to face with some of the issues facing the cell and gene therapy industry and gain insight into the steps we can take to propel us to where we need to be. I wanted to start this conversation with Tay and get his thoughts on where we are now, where we're going, and of course, the why. Hi, thanks for joining us on the TTP Invent podcast. It's really good to see you. Could you introduce yourself and say a little bit about what you do at Novartis?
Currently, what I do at AveXis, which was bought by Novartis, a gene therapy company, is I head up their chief access officer role, looking at worldwide commercialization of one-time regenerative medicines, whether they be AAV, gene therapies, our proprietary technology. Being part of that executive management team, we're really indexed on how we take these 21st century medicines and make them a relevant therapeutic category for patients, families, caregivers around the world in healthcare systems, frankly, designed for chronic treatment and follow-up. And there lies the polarity where you have a medicine that potentially can halt a disease in its tracks or change the natural history of the disease. You are dealing with healthcare systems that were really built around ongoing chronic management. So that's what we do, and that's what energizes us every day.
If you think 20 years ago, some of these conditions were more or less a death sentence, and now it isn't. How far are we along that road to being able to treat everybody who needs treatment with some of these new 21st century medicines?
It would be disingenuous to say at the point of we've reached summit. Far from. Because look, let's go back a little bit. We work in an area where you work on 90% plus rates of failure and learning. So every 9 medicines out of 10 potentially won't make their way forward. That shows you that there has to be a mindset of resilience of once you fail, you have to pick up and restart and make sure you keep driving forward with purpose. Coming back to the area of regenerative medicines, there was some recent data from ARM, the Alliance of Regenerative Medicines, that basically published, Bio has this, IQVIA has published on it, that it's 3.5 times likely that you'll see approvals for these types of therapies, these regenerative medicines versus standard drugs, 48% in phase 1, 65% in phase two and 30% in phase three versus the standard approvals. And why is that? Because you're really looking at very specific populations. You're looking at the mutations of those populations. You're looking at potentially trials that allow you to not go very broad, but go very specific in terms of the label population. And what has that resulted in, just where were we at in terms of on our journey to Summit, is we had five approvals in the space between 2017 and 2022. Only last year in 2023, we had five approvals for gene therapies for DMD, for hemophilia A, for sickle cell disease 2, and then one for this condition called dystrophic epidermolysis bullosa. In 2024, we're slated in Europe and the United States potentially to go between 12 and 17 approvals.
After hearing about the potential benefits for patients, I wanted to know more about how healthcare systems are adapting and enabling the commercialization of these therapies.
I'm going to do it in two parts. The first part is, when I say start with the commercial, the potential in mind, what does that actually mean? That means double-clicking into the diagnostic odyssey of what patients and families, caregivers go through on a daily basis. So what I'm saying is we want to avoid even pitfalls of the past where products got approved and then they were withdrawn. We're talking, for example, Glybera. We're talking about CAR therapy that tried to get to Europe and then they couldn't commercialize. We don't want any of that, right? This is the pain that early innovators have paid for, paving the way for others to come.
Yes, exactly. We don't want to have to go down the same path, right? We want to learn.
You got it. And that's why I hone in on what is the potential or what are you trying to address? And it starts by that deep journey you take on saying, what is it we need to solve for that patient? In the area of spinal muscular atrophy, patients who don't live, a very high percentage of their natural history, 80% plus, don't get live to see their second birthday. So how do you make sure that a copy of the SM1 gene that is then put into the patient helps course correct and ensure that versus natural history, a patient can live a normal course of life, achieve milestones that you and me may have had as a given, which is sitting and standing, walking and talking, swallowing. So this is really important. And that helps you shape the unmet need you're going after versus the standard of care. But let's say, for example, you and me have a bias towards these therapies and we want them to do well. But really, we should suppress that bias and say, what is it the net therapeutic gain we're trying to achieve in a sector of autoimmune disease or in oncology or in hematology? And can gene therapy, can cell therapy help us elevate that net therapeutic gain as an enabler? Not the other way around, that I have this technology and I'm going after that disease. No, you need to know, are you going after survival? Are you going after making sure that a child no longer needs to sit on a ventilator? And these markers are huge. And I have seen an openness from regulators around the world to try and help manufacturers on that journey and really crystallize what that right development looks like. Then what is the comparator? Because if you don't do all that work up front, what actually happens is you then get to regulatory approval and say, that's fine. Then you get into the market. And what happens is you start hitting all these hurdles where you get compared to standard of care, or you get compared to, you missed an endpoint. So this is really critical.
It seems like decisions that you make really early on in the development can have a significant impact on patient access downstream. What do you think the key decisions people need to think of when they're developing the therapy, and how does that kind of flow through to whether it's going to be a success or not in terms of the patient?
Very good point. We often say there's two things that make or break these types of therapies. The first is an upstream one, which is very close to what you guys do, and which is the manufacturing, right? Can you have reproducibility from trial to commercial product? Can you actually scale? Do you have enough material partnerships to actually then make what you need to serve?
As Tay mentioned, in the cell and gene therapy field, the question of patient access
is intertwined with our ability to produce the necessary doses at scale. I was interested to hear Tay's perspective on how choices made during process development impact on the ability to scale manufacturing. There's a few things that I'm just going to pull together that might be interesting to look at. Thinking about time to market from bench to bedside, that development piece where you're looking at the processes and you're trying to make improvements, how can we make that part faster? But it's also deciding that the manufacturing scale might be easier so that it's easier to deliver, so that the storage is less cumbersome. I mean, there's all sorts of decisions you could make, but how do you need to organize yourself so that process development is streamlined?
Look, there's so many themes in all of that, whether you're working on autologous therapy, allogenic, or simply an AAV type intervention. And you already started answering that in a thoughtful way around you've modulated manufacturing. Then you thought about, okay, we're now into man or in the clinic. So where do we choose those sites? Because imagine, like, if you're dealing with monogenic diseases, there is certain disproportionate populations around the world that are impacted. You know, you have to be thoughtful around that as well. Populations shouldn't be an afterthought.
No, where should you cite your trial?
It's exactly the strategic decision and recce that you need to do and say, how do we make site readiness happen? And because you've got to imagine that some of these sites will be doing this for the first time.
This is it. So some of the manufacturing processes, they can't be things that you need to have 10 years training to be able to operate.
I think partnerships is big for me because through this sort of, I would say, almost a decade of in these platforms, I have found that we would never have got to where we got to without the purpose partnerships that we built. And with so there's two types. One is on the manufacturing side, on the upstream side, on diagnostic side, on making sure therapy can get shipped around the world. And then on the other side with payers, physicians, patient groups. And I think all of that allows you to A, challenge your bias, and B, develop solutions that are potentially then going to land and be executed. Otherwise, you're pretty much trying to lead the blind versus the blind and doing something on your own. And that, for me, is not very conducive in this space.
How about the diversity of modalities, right? So people talk about cell and gene therapy, and then you've obviously got engineered cells, you've got gene therapy, but you've also got things like TILs as well. How does the industry cope with just the sheer diversity? Because that's quite difficult to put into a one-size-fits-all biologics or small molecule thinking.
Yeah, it's a good question. Got the gene editing, and we had the first gene-edited sickle cell disease product approved from CRISPR. I think when Novartis has gone an inch wide, foot deep on the CART platform, and then the next generation platform that they're developing, and then they're certainly in the AAV space, and then that went to a realization of, oh, we need to improve our game in the capsids and making sure that if we want to get to areas of the brain, how do we do that? Built another partnerships. There's often a view that you go a foot wide and an inch deep, or do you go an inch wide and a foot deep?
So yeah, there's a case of elevating again. There's also an approach where you maybe make some pragmatic compromises in order to reach that goal of saying, I do want to treat those 80% of patients. I wonder if you've come across any approaches that work particularly well there, or maybe you were surprised that it was done in this way, but proved to be particularly effective.
So remember I said to you, or you may recall in the early part of this discussion a few times, that deeper understanding of what patients and families and the diagnostic odyssey, what do people go through on a daily basis? So about 5 years ago, we started an effort with the government of Ghana to look at newborn screening diagnostics and access to basic medications, pain, vaccines, and hydroxyurea. And now it's scaled up to 4 or 5 different African countries, multiple partners. The reason was, what is the point of having gene therapy or cell therapy for sickle cell disease if you can't preserve the organs and make sure that Tay and Stuart have access to the basic standards of care? It doesn't make sense, because when your baseline characteristics will be way worse off if you don't get that when you get the gene therapy. So you have to almost, when I said to go an inch wide, foot deep, you have to play the long game, there has to be those elements of, as I said, partnership. But once you understand what you're going after, then it allows you to then tailor your trials and your interventions to ensure that the magnitude of benefit that your intervention is going to potentially get in the TPP has a maximum chance of success.
It was fascinating to hear Tay's views on the motivations for adopting new technologies within the pharmaceutical industry. At the end of the day, it clearly has to be driven by patient need. But with new modalities challenging development and access models, I wondered whether any lessons Tay had learned about fostering innovative thinking within large organisations. What does a big pharma like Novartis get out of the equation, right? You would have described what AveXis gets out of it, but what does Novartis get out of it?
So AveXis now, which is formerly part of Novartis, the parent company, imagine the journey is you start off in a very small organization, you're very innovative, you are able to take, I would say, create a new playbook for how you develop these, I would call them sometimes Star Wars medicines, work and co-create with regulators a pathway to potentially how they will be approved, and then work with HTA and regulatory bodies around the world to say how they'll be evaluated, and then work with patient groups and society to make sure there's an understanding of how these treatments will be used in the real world. And you've got to imagine in the 80s and 90s, early 2000s, and the history of big pharma has been really indexed around small molecules, biologics, vaccines, and they've learned their art and done it extremely well. And they have automated systems that are able to get pills of the past into a pharmacy. But you now have autologous treatments. You have treatments where you need to get the diagnostic right, the titers of the patient. You need to make sure that the product is then available. All stuff you guys are familiar with in the CART space. Even in the gene therapy space, all of this is almost sometimes in reverse. You're thinking about the patient first, making sure you understand where the patient is geographically, where the physician is, and then you're actually shipping product rather than the product's already there. And, you know, at times for folks, it can be a nuanced puzzle, but it's actually very energizing and rewarding to try and work with like-minded people who are really trying to elevate the industry's impact by bringing these one-time, I would say, curative potential regenerative medicines to patients. And I actually thought, honestly, in my lifetime, I wouldn't see a moment like this.
It's been very kind of inspirational speaking to you about this, and really, you can really tell the passion that you're steeped in the industry. When we look back at history and say, Kymriah being the first cell therapy on the market, will people say that was a big milestone? That was the start of something. And what do you think people will think about that moment in the future?
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I'm thinking we are in this sort of polarity of these 21st century medicines in healthcare systems designed for chronic follow-up care. And Kymriah, for me, it's in some respects, it was that first approval that gave the oxygen for others to also say this can happen. But it was full of a playbook of learning. I think fast forward to 2024, or now in this period of, as I said, we've reached nearly 4,000 patients with our AAV. And sometimes often from the outside, and people say, oh, wow, that's a slam dunk and it's a unicorn at times. And there's different words people use. But all I can say, again, just to bring it to reality, that we went country by country, plan by plan. When I say plan by plan, state by state, payer by payer, policy by policy, to make sure that we could provide a opportunity to partner without making someone feel vulnerable, and at the same time, co-create in a way that would allow and serve as an example for others to come, rather than be a reservoir and we say we've done this all ourselves. When recently someone in the executive role and a board member said to me, we probably don't need to do some of that hard work now. that was nice because that actually tells me that now is being received in service of the industry. And that for me, I think, is a more purpose-driven leadership rather than you're a reservoir and you take everything for the hero for the day.
I really enjoyed my conversation with Tay. It was interesting to hear his perspective on getting therapies to patients and what we need to prioritise to broaden access. Some of my key takeaways from our conversation were understanding the patient journey. We can't disregard the impact these therapies are having on the lives of patients. And this is actually driving innovation in healthcare systems to widen access. The need for partnerships. Tay highlighted that the real path forward involves partnerships across countries, companies, and healthcare systems. Collaboration is key to progress. Perseverance is essential. Tay mentioned that we are far from the summit. While we've made significant strides, we still have a long way to go and must keep pushing forward and innovating. Next, I spoke with Jason Jones to get his perspective on the why. Jason is passionate about the power of automation to scale therapies. Like Tay, he wants to streamline processes to make this a reality. His why is closely tied to his conviction that we should be doing more with automation. He explains how he's finding new ways to augment legacy processes so they can meet the future needs of the industry. Hi, and thanks for coming on the TTP Invent podcast. It's really good to see you. For our listeners, would you mind just saying who you are and what you do?
I'm Jason Jones. I'm the Global Business Development Lead for Cellular Origins.
And what does that involve?
Considering that I'm in a company of biologists and engineers, I describe myself as the talky one. So essentially, my role is to maintain and develop current client relationships, bring in new clients and develop those relationships. We have a lot of partners in the industry, other technology companies. We have a very collaborative approach. So developing, maintaining those relationships to those business and paperwork and anything business development wise around that. The sales element to it too, and a marketing element as well. As typical to a lot of startup companies, a bit of everything. But yeah, anything in terms of the external world, our industry's viewpoint on us and our viewpoint of them.
I think that's really interesting viewpoint. You're seeing things from startup in the ecosystem, but also you get to talk to end users like pharma companies and other technology providers as well. Is that a fair characterization?
Absolutely. It's a proper trans-industry point of view. A lot of trans-industry touch points, which is fantastic because you'll gain from as this conversation as we go on. I have a real passion for this. I've had moments over the last 20, 21 years where I've wondered about being in this industry, but always I return to the fact that this is something where my heart is in and that we've got to achieve the things we want to achieve in it.
From where you sit today, would you say that we are getting quite good at making CAR T therapies at an industrial scale?
I'll be as bold as saying no. To qualify that, so people say what has changed since in the last 20 years in terms of cell and gene manufacturing, in some ways a lot, but in many ways, not a lot at all. In fact, to a disappointing degree. So have we got good at it? I think we've got good at making do. And I think we've got good at squeezing every ounce of potential out of the kind of technology that we use at the moment and of experienced and qualified people in manufacturing facilities around the world now in terms of what kind of production output we can achieve.
So you're saying you feel like you're wringing out the last few drops from our kind of capability at the moment. What does it look like if we continue down the path that we're on?
As of this year onwards, actually, we're approaching some kind of crunch point, or I think there's a cliff edge. I can almost visualize it, grassy cliff edge that you're skidding towards. And kind of, one of those kind of horrible dreams. I think cell and gene therapy is going from strength to strength. And I think a lot of the milestones have been achieved this year. I think we're going through a transition. It's not slap you in the face obvious, But we had the big advent of approved therapies 2016, 2017 with Strumvelis, with Kymriah, with Yescarta getting approval and coming into the marketplace. That's fantastic. But really, what's happened since? And yeah, of course, a lot of work, but not in terms of approvals yet and not in terms of patient access. Companies like Novartis and Kite have done incredibly well to ramp up to meet as many of their patients as they can. But leukemia and lymphoma is the tip of the iceberg. And I say tip of the iceberg. I don't even know if we knew it was an iceberg, because what's happening now? So with the advent of the approval of Casgevy last year, that's a gene-modified stem cell therapy for sickle cell anemia and transfusion-dependent beta thalassemia. Those are not small patient numbers, not really, not as far as it can reach. You add into that, then this year we've had the multiple myeloma CAR-T therapies, Abecma and Carvykti, achieve in second and, or putting in respective order, third line and second line treatments. We're now at a stage where we need to ramp up to be able, as an industry, to be able to produce tens of thousands of products a year rather than the thousands we've been achieving now. So a log difference minimum.
Take us through a cell therapy manufacturing facility right now. What does that look like? Can you paint a picture for us?
Firstly, it's a clean room. I think I can say one thing we've achieved, we have managed to close a lot of processes out. On the whole, you might find yourself in a grade C or D clean room these days, but there will still have to be a grade A or grade B clean room with a grade A area in somewhere nearby or an isolator, because still things like raw material preparation, et cetera, needs to be done in a grade A area. Everyone will be gowned. Everyone would have been trained to be gowned and then signed off that they've been trained to be gowned. Sterility is still absolutely topmost of everyone's thoughts. Everything is SOP-led. You will see pieces of equipment in there that are those islands of automation that I talked about. So there'll be cell washers in there. In fact, even prior to that, there'll be thawing devices, cell washers, some way of selecting specific cell populations. And there would be a lot of incubation devices, whether it be incubators themselves or different bioreactors. Thereafter, something for fill and finishing, and then some cryogenic freezers of some description too. All based around an infrastructure of cleanliness, or very specific routes for materials, very specific routes for the personnel, inputs and output areas, and a lot of warehousing behind all of that as well.
I mean, a lot of that you've described sounds like a laboratory rather than a manufacturing facility. I don't want to denigrate, but there are elements of that where you're like, yes, people gowned up, working at instruments, not sort of a 21st century automated manufacturing facility.
You're right. It doesn't look like a 19th or 20th century lab with smoke coming out of conical flasks, but it's still laboratory-based. And what we need is a factory-based layout. What does it look like? I mean, somewhat biased here, but the reason I'm here at Cellular Origins is that I think the future has to look a little bit more like, probably in most of my conversations, people would use the analogy a lot more of car manufacturing. It's a pun that I don't think it was even thought of as a pun anymore, to look at CAR-T manufacturing as car manufacturing. But at least that kind of, I mean, I don't think we'll have conveyor belts in clean room facilities, but more the robotic handling of materials, of bringing in materials, of operating those instruments that I say are all on benchtops at the moment. And that are all strangely, actually, although they're automation devices, they're actually designed and built for automating processes that people are handling. Manufacturing-wise, if you look across industries, we're very used to manufacturing very complex things at high levels. Why haven't we done it in cell and gene so far? We haven't evolved to some degree because there are certain restrictions put on us. It's GMP manufacturing. It's risk adverse at necessity, and change is risk, right? So we've had to get to a point where the risk of not changing is higher than the risk of changing.
Yeah. So you're saying up to this point, the risk of change has been high, but now the risk of not changing is higher.
Yes, the risk of changing is still high, but the risk of not changing is even higher. So in some ways, I don't want to do them out of what they've achieved, because it, it helps. But these pieces of automation rely on people to put everything on, move everything to them and between them, and to operate them. I mean, everything's got a touch screen and needs a human finger to touch it. We're looking to reorientate some of that, Cellular Origins, and make it look a lot more like a cross between car manufacturing line and a smart warehouse. There's two ways you can introduce robotics into cell and gene therapy manufacturing, and that's you have a fixed robotic arm that can do all your manipulations and you bring things to it, which doesn't get you much further really than where we were with taking it to individual pieces of equipment. Or you can have mobile robots that will transfer between all of those different stations of automation. And that's certainly what we believe in. That's how I envisage the future being, that we can have, let's say we can turn around from having 20 people in a manufacturing room to having one person in an office next to the manufacturing room monitoring what's going on. And in that way, you can run those plants 24/7, 365 days a year, even an extra day on a leap year, and you can really expand that kind of output. But also you need to do that in a way that if you multiply your output, if you increase your scale, you do have to have a higher degree of quality. Because let's say you have something like a 1% failure rate, you're then looking at 100 times more output, you've got 100 times more failures as well.
It was exciting to hear about the work Jason and his team are doing to address the scaling issues in cell and gene therapy manufacture. As we've heard earlier in the episode, decisions made in the early stages of development can have a large impact on the ability to scale. I wondered if Jason had any advice for companies at this stage. What would you suggest to somebody who is in an earlier stage of development, who's maybe getting some good biological responses and thinking, how am I going to develop this process? What would you suggest to them in order to set them up for scale in the best way?
I think there's a great capital outlay in any kind of fully automated system at the beginning of these things. So I used to say, when I was working with just devices, new instrumentation that would sit on a benchtop, I used to say as early as possible. Because then you're not gonna change anything later on, and you'd already be used to it. And in fact, it could potentially speed up your process development work as well. With a full automation platform, it's not going to be possible for early therapy developers to invest in that kind of capital outlay and the facilities that would go in. And in fact, how much money would you waste over the subsequent 6, 8, 10 years of developing your product by keeping it online? It's unviable. So I would say my advice would be to talk to the manufacturers and providers of the technology that you're using about what their roadway, their pathway to fuller automation is. And for example, us at Cellular Origins are coming in from the other side, and we're working with those providers to adapt and integrate their systems into our full automation platforms. I would be bold enough to ask those technology providers what the pathway is. If they haven't got one, then they would suggest when you need to produce 50,000 products a year, for example.
Okay, so actually it's being willing to go on a journey with your technology providers, because you're going to be going on this journey and they need to come along with you, or you need to have the confidence that they're going to come along with you.
I mean, I can say from all of my experience that you're on a journey with them anyway, and it's not an arm length journey either. If you're utilizing technology in your process, your whole company relies on the therapy, it relies on the quality of that therapy and its success. So you have to be in a trusted relationship with your technology providers. I add that S on purpose. It's normally multiple, because you're on a journey together. And like I say, you have to trust your technology provider to maintain the quality and the supply. I would add to that, to circle back to how we started this part, I would add to that you need to trust that they have a pathway to full automation and higher scale. Yeah.
That leads me to ask a bit about maybe when you were working with some of those device, working for some of those device companies and trying to place new equipment in pharma companies. How easy is it to deploy brand new technology in a pharmaceutical company? What challenges have you seen?
Easy answer is not easy. There are some well-described metrics out there, technology uptake curves, for example. You have your early adopters, you have your innovators, then you have the main crowd, the tool bit of the curve. And then in a technology life cycle, there's a tail off as well. So technology uptake is well described. I'd say it's a little harder in our industry. So what do you need? You need a piece of technology that moves the needle enough, especially now that there's a lot of different choices in whatever unit operation you're looking at. Why would you choose one piece of technology over another is one question. And if something new comes in, what would make you change from something that you've been relatively satisfied with? It has to do more of what you want, more of what you require, whether that be now or later. So I would say usually that would mean don't touch the biology, but potentially it can make your process quicker. It could potentially, you can have more viable sales at the end of it, maybe. But on the whole, probably you're going to want to be able to make more and more of those products through that technology as you go along. But it's got to move the needle. Otherwise, why do it?
Help me make this argument then, Jason, to say, look, planning for scale is the needle mover that you need to consider early on. How would you phrase that more eloquently?
A therapy developer has to think about where they want to be. Undoubtedly, it's treating patients. But is it patients in a clinical trial? I don't think so. I don't think that's the end point of anybody's journey. It's about treating as many patients as there are, really, that can benefit from the therapy and having as big an impact on the medical world as you can, making human life a bit more bearable in disease cases, making life a bit fairer for those families whose children or loved ones or whoever are suffering from, whether it be cancer or terrible autoimmune diseases or whatever it be. I always thought, especially in oncology, that cancers often, they're genetic predispositions, but often it's a roll of the dice.
Yeah. For sake of argument, we have a few facilities in the future now where it is fully automated, controlled by one person, looks much more like a car manufacturing plant. Do you foresee any bottlenecks now coming into that manufacturing process or as a result of that manufacturing process? What's the next hurdle?
That final vision. And by the way, I don't think it'll ever be like just one person running a production factory, but certainly a lot fewer than there could be. You know, I certainly think with some of the technology we're looking at now around implementing robotics, implementing industrialization technology from other industries, finally into cell and gene, we could get to a point where we've nailed the manufacturing, we have greater standardization, greater reproducibility, that we have a greater depth of data around the process because everything's digital. Like every mere millimeter movement of the product or materials through the process is recorded. Yeah, we could nail all of that. We could get it down to near to zero process variability. We will, of course, still have the inherent variability in the patient product or the donor product. But the bigger, more immediate worry after we've nailed manufacturing, that's not going to be no work, is that everything around it. The easy one that a lot of people talk about is the analytics, right? So you're producing more products. Okay, that's great. You're doing well at that. But how do you quality control? How do you analyze the product?
Yeah, suddenly a QC lab's receiving 100 batches a day rather than just one.
So I do have some hope in that. I think we've got to think smart about it. We've got to utilize technologies again. But there is a lot out there now.
In COVID, there was a lot of open collaboration between pharma companies, universities, institutes, manufacturers, equipment companies. Are you calling for something like that? Do you think that would help us get over this hump in the next 2 to 5 years?
Yes, in short. Goes back to my kind of daydreams where I think about what if we all just put the resources we need into this for a short amount of time, which would actually probably cost a lot less too. It probably is. I say it probably isn't going to happen. It's not going to necessarily happen in any kind of methodical
way. Right, yeah.
But I would say it's organically beginning to happen one way or another. It almost takes a sort of facilitator out there. To some degrees, I do see the technology we're bringing to the industry as being that facilitation, the outside of a jigsaw puzzle that we can then fit the other bits that already exist into. And actually, the partners we're working with, technology developers in the field around all different process and instrumentation and so on, have been very open, very warm to essentially what is a common goal, that we can implement more automation to achieve more scale. And that we're working, certainly in my day-to-day work now, I'm working in a very collaborative way with a number of partners. And there will be more as we go on to achieve what you were just talking about, with the therapy of developers involved as well.
Clearly, Jason has a lot of belief in the power of technology to enable cell and gene therapies to reach their full potential. So I was interested to hear what the future looks like to him. So we're recording in 2024, and this seems to be a year where we're getting a lot of approvals in cell and gene therapies. We already know more than 10 years on from some of the first patients, and they are effectively cured of their cancer. Is it a done deal? Have we finished cell and gene therapy development? Surely we're good to go, right?
I don't think many people really up to their armpits in the industry is gonna say that. There's so much more work to do, a lot of which we've discussed. But from the sort of slight outside looking in, I have heard that term used, actually, or at least inferred that, well, cell and gene was a success, right? Let's invest in oligonucleotides, or let's bring out new grants around mRNA production. What fantastically promising areas. Was cell and gene therapy a success? No, we've really not even come out of the beginning of it. We've got so much more to do in terms of approvals to come, challenges around manufacturing to bring the cost of goods down. But we have to reduce the cost of these therapies, or potentially we can afford, health authorities can afford them now, but they're not going to be able to afford them when there are 100, 200 approved therapies in the industry. Is it a done deal? I almost react quite violently when I hear that, and especially around funding organizations and more sort of national, broader like bioprocessing organizations. I say, no.
We've come so far. Don't stop now.
It's short-termism. It exists in politics. It exists in many walks of life, and it exists somewhat around medicine, medical development, and biotech. No, it's not a done deal. We've got so much more to do. We've got more to invest to make the returns what they should be, whether that be around the good that we can do with patients, for patients and their families, or whether it be the bottom line dollar on your return of investment. I'd say we don't have much further to go before we can reach more patients. That kind of means that, again, the financial returns are going to be so much higher. I hope we enter into a new kind of period of positive feedback around that now. Is it done? No way. But it looks so promising that we'd be foolish to turn away now. And yeah, please keep the interest and the investment coming into the area.
What's your kind of like best case scenario? What's your best case vision for the future in, say, 10 years time? Where might we be?
It could even be 20 years, but we'll have successes on the way. And where I want to see us, cell and gene therapy should be accessible to everybody that requires them, right? We're getting to a point where if you have a certain type of leukemia, lymphoma, or myeloma, and you've tried standard treatments, then you can then get a therapy that you should respond to, the probability-wise you should respond to. I'd like to get to a point where we have that option for many more patients, hundreds of thousands of patients.
It doesn't seem fair to have any other ambition.
If it can benefit patients, then it should do. And I'll say again as well, not to just think about the patients, but their families and friends around them. If it's a disease where it's life or death, and not even that, actually, some of the autoimmune diseases, the standard of living for some of these patients is really appalling, that you can make such a difference to so many patients with a kind of medicine that really sort of didn't exist 30 years ago, not really, would be, I'm biased, I've spent all my professional career in this field, but it would be what we're all working towards, I think. It would be a revolution of kinds, certainly in medicine.
It was great to get Jason's perspective. Here are my three takeaways from our discussion. The technology we need already exists. Much of the technology required to further automate our processes is already available from other industries. We just need to adapt it and continue to innovate. The time is now. It's crucial that we lay the groundwork for the next steps immediately, or we risk additional development effort that adds cost and could hinder innovation. It's about partnerships. As the industry matures, technology developers and therapy developers are going to need to collaborate to eliminate bottlenecks and streamline processes. As we heard from both Tay and Jason, the why of cell and gene therapies is the incredible potential they have to make a real difference to patients' lives. But we cannot continue to develop life-changing therapies in isolation without paying attention to the means of producing these at scale. Thanks to the work of people like Jason, Tay, and others, we are changing the mindset of the industry to enable more collaboration and create an environment for innovative solutions, which should help ensure widespread patient access. Thank you to both Tay and Jason for joining the podcast today and sharing their insights. In the next episode, I'll be exploring how out-of-the-box thinking can decrease costs and increase the speed of development. And at the end of these two episodes, I hope you'll feel closer to understanding the why and the how that are driving progress and investment in the cell and gene therapy industry.